All hands not directly involved with the flying of the ship gazed in wide-eyed wonder at this enchanted realm. There must be water in abundance, was almost everyone's first thought. The ground was covered with lush vegetation. Tall trees with green leaves dotted a landscape of rolling hills. Here and there, tall pearl spires stood against the sky. Broad roads crisscrossed the valleys and vanished over the ridges. Sinistrad flew before them, the quicksilver dragon streaking like a comet across the sun-drenched sky, making the graceful dragon ship seem lumbering and clumsy by comparison. They followed his lead, and ahead of them, on the horizon, a cluster of spires appeared. Sinistrad aimed the dragon's head toward this location, and as the elven ship drew nearer, all on board saw it was a gigantic city. Hugh had once, during his days as a slave, visited the capital city of Aristagon, of which the elves were very justly proud. The beauty of its buildings, which are made of coralite molded into artistic shapes by skilled elven craftsmen, are legendary. But the jewels of Tribus were common paste and glass when compared to the wondrous city that lay glistening before them, a handful of pearls scattered over green velvet with an occasional ruby or sapphire or diamond set among them. A silence of profound awe, almost reverence, filled the elven ship. No one spoke, as if fearful of disturbing a lovely dream. Hugh had been taught by the Kyr monks that beauty is ephemeral, and all man's work will come to naught but dust in the end. He'd seen nothing yet in his lifetime to convince him otherwise, but now he began to think maybe he'd been wrong. Tears ran down Limbeck's cheeks. He was constantly forced to remove his spectacles and wipe them off so that he could see. Alfred appeared to forget whatever inner torment he was suffering and gazed out on the city with a face softened by what one might almost call melancholy. As for Haplo, if he was impressed, he didn't show it, other than evincing a mild interest as he stared with the rest of them out the porthole. But then, Hugh thought, scrutinizing the man carefully, that face of his never shows anything. Fear, elation, worry, happiness, anger. And yet, if one looked carefully, there were traces, almost like scars, of emotions that had cut deep. The man's will alone had smoothed them out. Almost, but not quite, erased them. No wonder he makes me want to keep putting my hand to my sword. I think I'd almost prefer an avowed enemy at my side than Haplo as a friend. Sitting at Haplo's feet, gazing about with more interest than its master evinced, the dog suddenly ducked its head and gnawed at its flank, apparently driven to search out an elusive itch. The elven ship entered the city. It drifted low over wide, flower-lined boulevards that wound among tall buildings. What these buildings were made of was anyone's guess. Smooth and sleek, they seemed to be created out of pearls, those gems that are sometimes found among the coralite and are rare and precious as drops of water. The elves sucked in their breaths and glanced at each other out of the corners of their almond eyes. A cornerstone of pearl alone would give them more wealth than their king himself possessed. Hugh, rubbing his hands, felt his spirits lift. If he got out of here alive, his fortune was made. Dropping lower, they could see beneath the vessel upturned faces stare at them curiously as they passed. The streets were crowded. The city's population must number in the thousands, Hugh reckoned. Sinistrad guided the ship to a huge central park and indicated by hand signals that here they were to drop anchor. A crowd of wizards had gathered here, gazing at them curiously. Though none of the Magi had ever seen a mechanical contraption such as this, they were quick to catch hold of the guy ropes tossed over the side by the elves and fasten them to trees. Captain Botherell caused the ship's wings to fold in almost completely, so that only a small bit of magic kept the vessel afloat. Hugh and his companions were brought to the bridge and arrived there the same moment as Sinistrad and Bane appeared, seeming to step out of the air. The Mysteriarch bowed respectfully to the captain.
"I trust your trip was not unduly difficult. Your ship sustained no damage from the ice."
"Little, thank you," replied Captain Botherell, bowing in turn. "What damage we sustain, we will be able to repair."
"My people and I will be most happy to furnish you with material, wood, rope."
"Thank you, that will not be necessary. We are accustomed to making do with what we have."
It was obvious that the beauty of this realm and all its wealth had not blinded Botherell's eyes. He was in alien lands among an enemy race. Hugh was growing to like this elf. There was, he could see, no need to warn Botherell of his danger. Sinistrad did not seem offended. Smiling a rictus smile, he said he hoped the crew would disembark and take in the pleasures of their city. Several of his people would come aboard and keep an eye on the slaves.
"Thank you. I myself and some of my officers may later be pleased to accept your invitation. As for now, we have work to do, and I will not want to burden you with responsibility for our slaves."
Sinistrad, it seemed, might have raised an eyebrow had he had one. As it was, the lines in his forehead lifted slightly, but he said nothing, merely bowed again in acquiescence, the smile deepening and darkening. I could make this ship mine in 5 seconds, if I wanted it, said the smile. Captain Botterell bowed, and he too smiled. Sinistrad's gaze slid over Hugh, Limbeck, and Alfred. It seemed they lingered for some time on Haplow, and the slight crease of a thoughtful frown appeared between the eyes. Haplow returned the inspection with his quiet, unassuming expression, and the frown line disappeared.
You will have no objection, I hope, sir, to my taking these passengers of yours to meet my wife and to stay as guests in my house. We are most beholden to them for saving the life of our only child.
Captain Botherell replied that he was certain his passengers would enjoy escaping the dull routine of shipboard life. Hugh, reading between the words, figured that the elf was glad to be rid of them. The hatch opened, a rope ladder was thrown out. Sinistrad and Bane left the bridge in their usual airy style. The others descended via the ladder. Hugh was the last one to leave the ship. Standing in the hatchway, watching the others slowly and clumsily make their way down, he was startled by a light touch on his arm. Turning, he looked into the eyes of the elf captain.
Yes, said Botherell. I know what he wants. I'll do my best to make certain he doesn't get it. If you come back with money, we'll get you out of here. We'll wait for you as long as we can hold out.
The elf's mouth twisted.
I expect to be paid as promised, one way or the other.
A cry and thud from below announced that Alfred, as usual, had come to grief. Hugh said nothing. There was nothing to say. All was understood. He began to climb down the ladder. The others were on the ground already, Haplow and Limbeck tending a prone and unconscious Alfred. Standing next to Haplow, licking Alfred's face, was the dog, and it occurred to Hugh to wonder as he descended how the animal or its master had managed such a remarkable feat. Hugh had never heard of a four-legged animal being able to climb down a rope ladder, but when he asked the others, no one seemed to have noticed. A group of 20 Mysteriarchs, 10 men and 10 women, was on hand to welcome them. Sinistrad introduced them as Mystagogues, teachers of the arcane and the ruling body of the city. They appeared to be of varying ages, though none were as young as Sinistrad. One couple looked to be ancient, their faces wizened masses of wrinkles, nearly hiding eyes that were shrewd and intelligent, and held in them knowledge amassed over who knew how many years. The others were in midlife, with firm, unlined faces, hair thick and richly colored, with only a few strands of silver or gray at the temples. They were pleasant and polite, welcoming visitors to their fair city, offering all in their power to make the stay memorable. Memorable. Hugh had a feeling it would be that at least. Walking among the wizards, hearing introductions, he looked into eyes that never looked into his, saw faces that might have been carved of the pearl substance around them, devoid of any expression other than polite and proper welcome. His sense of danger and unease grew, and was made manifest by a peculiar incident.
I was wondering, my friends, if you would care to walk about our city and view its wonders.
My own dwelling is some distance away, and you may not have another opportunity to see much of New Hope before you have to leave.
All agreed, and having ascertained that Alfred was not injured, beyond a bump on the head, they followed Sinistrad through the park. Crowds of wizards gathered on the grass or sat beneath the trees to stare at them as they passed, but no one said a word, either to them or to a neighbor. The silence was eerie, and Hugh felt that he much preferred the thumping and banging of the Kixi-Winsy. Reaching the sidewalk, he and his companions stood among the glittering buildings whose spires soared into the rainbow-shimmering sky. Arched doorways led to cool, shadowy courtyards. Arched windows gave glimpses of fabulous luxuries inside.
These to your left belong to the College of the Arcane, where we teach our young. Across are the dwellings of the students and professors. The very tallest building that you can see from here is the seat of government, where sit the members of the council whom you have just met. Ah, I must warn you of one thing.
Sinistrad, who had been walking with one hand resting lovingly on the shoulder of his son, turned around to face them. The material used in our buildings is made magically, and therefore is not, how shall I put it so that you will understand, let us say, it is not of this world. And so it would be a good idea if you, being of the world, did not touch it.
Ah, there, what did I say?
Limbeck, ever curious, had reached out his hand to run his fingers over the smooth, pearly stone. There was a sizzle, and the geg yelped in pain and snatched back burned fingers.
He doesn't understand your language, said Alfred, with a rebuking glance at the wizard.
Then I suggest that one of you translate, returned Sinistrad. The next time it might cost him his life.
Limbeck stared in awe at the buildings, sucking on the tips of his hurt fingers. Alfred imparted the warning to the geg in a low voice, and they continued on down the street, new wonders continually unfolding before their eyes. The sidewalks were massed with people, coming and going on their business, and all staring at them curiously and in silence. Alfred and Limbeck kept pace with Bane and Sinistrad. Hugh was doing the same until he noticed Haplo lagging behind, walking slowly to assist his dog, which had suddenly developed a limp in one foot. Hugh, answering a silent request, paused to wait for them. They were a long time coming. The dog was in obvious discomfort, and the others drew well ahead. Haplo stopped and knelt down beside the animal, seemingly absorbed in its injury. Hugh joined him. "Well, what's the matter with the mutt?"
"Nothing, really. I wanted to show you something."
"Reach out and touch that wall behind me."
"Are you crazy? You want to see me burn my fingers off?"
"Go ahead," said Haplo with his quiet smile. The dog was grinning at Hugh as if sharing a wonderful secret. "You won't get hurt." Feeling very much like a boy who can't resist a dare, though he knows he'll only end up in trouble, Hugh gingerly stretched out his hand toward the pearl-glistening wall. He cringed in expected pain when his fingers touched the surface, but he felt nothing. Absolutely nothing. His fingers went completely through the stone. The building was solid as a cloud.
"What the..."
"Illusion," said Haplo. He patted the dog on the flank. "Come on, the wizard's looking at us." "Thorn in its paw," he called out to Sinistrad. "I removed it. The dog will be all right now." Sinistrad regarded them with narrow-eyed suspicion, perhaps wondering where the dog had managed to pick up a thorn in the middle of the city. He continued on, however, though it seemed that his speech about the wonders of New Hope was a bit forced, the descriptions delivered somewhat bitingly. Hugh, mystified, nudged Haplo.
"Why?"
Haplo shrugged.
"There's something else, too," he said in a low voice, the words coming out of the corner of his mouth so that if Sinistrad glanced back, they would not seem to be talking. "Take a close look at all these people around us. They're a quiet bunch, I can say that for them. Look at them closely."
Hugh did as he was told.
"There is something strange about them," he admitted.
"They look..." He paused.
"Familiar?"
"Yeah, familiar. Like I've seen them somewhere before. But that's not possible."
"Yes, it is. If you're seeing the same 20 people over and over."
At that moment, almost as if he had overheard, Sinistrad brought the tour to an abrupt halt. "It is time we traveled on to my humble dwelling," he said. "My wife will be waiting." Chapter 49. Castle Sinister, High Realm. The Quicksilver Dragon carried them to Sinistrad's dwelling. They did not travel far. The castle seemed to float on a cloud and commanded, whenever the mists parted, a view of the city of New Hope that was spectacular, breathtaking, and, to Hugh's mind, disturbing. The buildings, the people, nothing but a dream. If so, whose? And why were they being invited, no, forced, to share it? Hugh's first action on entering the castle was to take a surreptitious poke at the wall. He noted Haplo doing the same, and both exchanged glances. The castle at least was solid. This was real. And the woman descending the stairs, was she real?
"Ah, there you are, my dear. I thought you would be out front waiting impatiently to greet your son."
The castle's entry hall was enormous, its dominating feature a grand staircase whose marble steps were so wide that a war dragon could have flown up it, wings fully extended, and never touched the sides. The interior walls were made of the same smooth, pearlized opal as the outer, and shimmered in the sunlight, shining softly through the shifting mists surrounding the castle. Tapestries of rich and wondrous beauty adorned the walls, rare and valuable articles of furniture, massive wooden chests, richly carved high-backed chairs lined the hallway. Ancient suits of human armor made of precious metals, inlaid with silver and gold, stood silent guard. The stairs were covered with a thick, smooth carpet made of woven wool. Halfway down the stairs, dwarfed by their massive size, they could see, once Sinistrat had drawn their attention to her, a woman. She stood frozen, staring at her child. Bane kept very near Sinistrad, the boy's small hand clinging tightly to the wizard's. The woman put her hand to a locket she wore at her throat and clasped her fingers round it. With her other, she leaned heavily against the balustrades. She had not stopped on the stair to make a grand entrance, to draw all eyes to her. She had stopped, Hugh saw, because she could go no farther. Hugh had wondered briefly what kind of woman Bane's mother was, what kind of woman would participate in a baby switching. He had thought he knew, and would not have been surprised to see someone as treacherous and ambitious as the father. Now, seeing her, he realized she was not a perpetrator, but a victim.
"My dear, have you taken root?" Sinistrad appeared displeased. "Why don't you speak, our guests?"
The woman was going to fall, and without pausing to think, Hugh ran upstairs and...
"So that's Mother," said Bane.
"Yes, my son," remarked Sinistrad.
"Gentlemen, my wife, Irridle." He waved a negligent hand at her motionless body. "I must apologize for her. She is weak, very weak.
And now, sirs, if you will follow me, I will show you to your quarters. I am certain you will want to rest after your fatiguing journey.
What about her, your wife?
Hugh demanded. He smelled the fragrance of crushed and faded lavender. Take her to her room, said Sinistrad, glancing at her without interest. It's at the top of the stairs along the balcony, second door to the left.
Should I call a servant to care for her?
We have no servants. I find them disruptive. She must care for herself, as must you all, I'm afraid. Without looking to see if their guests were following, Sinistrad and Bane turned to the right and walked through a door that appeared, seemingly by the wizard's command, in a blank wall. The others did not immediately go after him. Haplo was idly looking around. Alfred was apparently torn between following his prince and attending to the poor woman in Hugh's arms. Limbeck looked with frightened round eyes at the door that had materialized out of solid rock and kept rubbing his ears, perhaps longing for a whoosh, zuzzed, wham to break the oppressive silence.
I suggest you follow me, gentlemen. You will never find your way alone. There are but few fixed rooms in this castle. The rest come and go as we need them. I deplore waste, you see.
The others, somewhat startled by this pronouncement, made their way through the door, Limbeck holding back until Alfred gently propelled him forward. Hugh wondered where the dog was, then, looking down, saw the animal at his feet.
Get along, Hugh snapped, shoving at the dog with a boot.
The animal dodged him neatly and remained standing on the stair, watching him with interest, head cocked to one side, ears erect. The woman in Hugh's arms stirred faintly and moaned. No other assistance from his companions being forthcoming, the assassin turned and carried the woman up the stairs. The climb to the balcony above was long, but the burden he bore was light, far too light. He carried her to her room, finding it without difficulty by the half-open door and the faint smell of the same sweet fragrance that clung to her. Inside was a sitting room, beyond that a dressing room, and beyond that her bedchamber. Passing through the various rooms, Hugh was surprised to see that they were almost devoid of furnishings. There were few decorations, and those that were visible were covered with dust. The atmosphere of these inner private chambers was chill and barren, far different from the warm luxury of the entry hall. Hugh laid Irridle gently upon a bed covered with sheets of finest linen trimmed with lace. He drew a silken coverlet over her thin body and then stood gazing at her. She was younger than he had first guessed on seeing her. Her hair was white but thick and as finely spun as gossamer. The face in repose was sweet, delicately molded and unlined. Her skin was pale, so dreadfully pale. Before Hugh could catch the dog, it slipped past and gave the woman's hand, hanging down beside the bed, a swipe with its tongue. Irridle stirred and woke. Her eyes fluttered open. She looked up at Hugh and fear contorted her features.
Go now, she whispered. You must go.
The sound of chanting greeted the sun in the chill morning. It was the song of black-robed monks descending on the village, driving away the other carrion birds. Each new child's birth we die in our hearts. Truth, black, we are shown. Death always returns with. Hugh and other boys trudged behind, shivering in their thin clothing, their bare feet stumbling numbly over frozen ground. They had come to look forward to the warmth of the terrible fires that would soon be burning in this village. There were no living people to be seen, only the dead, lying in the streets where their relatives had tossed the plague-infested bodies, then gone into hiding against the coming of the cure. At a few doors, however, stood baskets of food, or perhaps, more precious, jugs of water, the village's payment for services rendered. The monks were accustomed to this. They went about their grim business, gathering the bodies, hauling them to the large open area where the orphans they sheltered were already heaping up char crystal. Other boys, Hugh among them, ran down the street gathering up the thank offerings that would be carried back to the monastery. Coming to one doorway, he heard a sound and paused in the act of lifting a loaf of bread from a basket. He looked inside.
Mother, said a little boy, starting to approach a woman lying on the bed. I'm hungry. Why don't you get out of bed? It's time for our breakfast.
I can't get up this morning, dear.
The mother's voice, though gentle, apparently sounded strange and unfamiliar to the child because it frightened him.
No, my sweet darling, don't come near me. I forbid it.
She drew a breath, and Hugh could hear it wheeze in her lungs. Her face was already as white as those of the corpses lying in the street, but he saw that once she had been pretty.
Let me look at you, Mikal. You will be good while I'm sick. Do you promise? Promise me,
she said weakly.
Yes, mother, I promise.
Go now, the woman said in a low voice. Her hands clenched the blankets.
You must go. Go. Fetch me some water.
The child turned and ran toward Hugh, who was standing in the doorway. Hugh saw the woman's body jerk in agony, then go rigid, then limp. The eyes stared up at the ceiling.
I must get water, water for mother,
the child said, looking up at Hugh. His back was turned. He had not seen.
I'll help carry it, said Hugh. You hold this.
He handed the boy the bread. Might as well get the child accustomed to his new life. Taking the little boy by the hand, Hugh led him away from the house. In the child's arms was the loaf of bread baked by a woman just as she was probably beginning to feel the first symptoms of the disease that would shortly claim her. Behind him, Hugh could still hear the soft echo of the mother's command, sending her child away so that he would not see her die.
Go now.
Water. Hugh lifted a carafe and poured a glass. Iridal did not glance at it, but kept her gaze fixed on him.
You.
Her voice was low and soft.
You are one of them, with my son.
Hugh nodded. The woman rose, half sitting in bed, propped up on her arm. Her face was pale. There was a fever in her lustrous eyes.
Go,
she repeated, speaking in a low, trembling voice.
You're in terrible danger. Leave this house, now.
Her eyes. Hugh was mesmerized by her eyes. They were large and deeply set, the irises every color of the rainbow, a glistening spectrum surrounding the black pupils that shifted and changed as the light struck them.
Do you hear me?
She demanded. Hugh hadn't really. Something about danger. Here, drink this, he said, thrusting the glass to water. Angrily, she knocked it aside. The goblet crashed to the floor, water running over the stone tiles.
Do you think I want your deaths, too, on my hands?
Tell me the danger, then. Why must we leave?
But the woman sank back on the pillows and would not answer him. Drawing near, he saw that she was shivering with fear.
What danger?
He bent down to pick up the pieces of broken glass, looking at her as he worked. The woman shook her head frenziedly. Her eyes darted about the room.
No, I've said enough, perhaps too much. He has eyes everywhere. His ears are always listening.
The fingers of her hands curled and closed in on the palms. It had been a long time since Hugh had felt another's pain. It had been a long time since he'd felt his own. From somewhere buried deep inside him, memories and feelings that had been lying dead came to life, stretched out bony hands and dug their nails into his soul. His hand jerked. A glass shard drove into his palm. The pain angered him. What do I do with this mess? Iridol made a weak gesture with her hand, and the broken glass he was holding in his hands vanished, as if it had never been.
I'm sorry you hurt yourself, she said in a dull, lifeless voice. But that is what you must expect if you insist on staying.
Averting his face from her, he turned to stare out the window. Far beneath him, its silvery skin visible through the shifting mists, the dragon had curled its huge body above the castle and lay there murmuring to itself over and over of its hatred for the wizard.
We can't leave, Hugh said. That dragon's out there guarding.
There are ways to avoid the quicksilver if you truly want to leave.
Hugh was silent, reluctant to tell her the truth, afraid of what he might hear in return. But he had to know.
I can't leave. I'm enthralled. Your son has me under enchantment.
Iridol stirred fitfully, glanced up at him with pitying eyes.
The enchantment works only because you want it to work. Your will feeds it. You could have broken it long ago if you truly wanted. So the wizard Tryon discovered. You care about the boy, you see, and caring is an invisible prison. I know, I know.
The dog, which had stretched out, nose on paws, upon the floor at Hugh's feet, suddenly sat bolt upright and stared around fiercely. Iridol gasped.
He's coming. Quickly leave me now. You have been here too long.
Hugh, his face dark and foreboding, did not move.
Oh, please leave me,
Iridol pleaded, stretching out her hands.
For my sake, I am the one who will be punished.
The dog was already on its feet and heading for the outer chambers. Hugh, with a final glance back at the stricken woman, thought it best to do as she said, for now at least. Until he could mull over what she had told him. Going out, he met Sinistrad in the door to the sitting room.
Your wife is resting.
Hugh forestalled any question.
Thank you. I am certain you made her very comfortable.
Sinistrad's lashless eyes flicked over Hugh's muscular arms and body. A knowing smile touched his thin lips. Hugh flushed in anger. He started to push past the wizard, but Sinistrad moved slightly to block his way.
You are hurt, said the Mysteriarch.
Reaching out, he took hold of Hugh's hand and turned it palm up to the light.
It's nothing, a broken glass, that's all. I cannot have my guests injured. Allow me.
Sinistrad laid fingers, thin and quivering like the legs of a spider, on Hugh's palm over the wound. Closing his eyes, the Mysteriarch concentrated. The jagged cut closed. The pain of the wound eased. Smiling, Sinistrad opened his eyes and looked intently into Hugh's.
"We're not your guests," said the hand. "We're your prisoners."
"That, my dear sir," replied the Mysteriarch, "is entirely up to you." One of the few rooms of the castle to remain constantly in the castle was the wizard's study. Its location, in relation to other rooms in the dwelling, shifted constantly, depending upon Sinistrad's moods and needs. This day, it was in the upper part of the castle, the curtains drawn to catch the last light of Solaris before the Lords of Night snuffed day's candle. Spread out on the wizard's large desk were the drawings his son had done of the great Kixie Winsie. Some were diagrams of parts of the huge machine that Bane personally had seen. Others had been created with Limbeck's help, and provided illustrations of the parts of the Kixie Winsie that operated on the rest of the Isle of Drevlin. The drawings were quite good, and remarkably accurate. Sinistrad had instructed the boy on how to use magic to enhance his work. Picturing the image in his mind, Bane had only to connect that image with the motion of his hand to translate what he saw onto paper. The wizard was studying the diagrams intently when a muffled bark caused him to raise his head.
"What is that dog doing in here?"
"He likes me," said Bane, throwing his arms around the dog's neck and hugging him.
The two had been roughhousing on the floor, which tussle had occasioned the bark.
"He always follows me around. He likes me better than he does Haplo, don't you, boy?"
The dog grinned, its tail thumping the floor.
"Don't be too certain of that."
Sinistrad fixed the animal with a piercing gaze.
"I don't trust it. I think we should get rid of it. In ancient times, magi used animals such as this to do their bidding, to go places they could not go and act as spies."
"But Haplo isn't a wizard. He's just a human."
"And one not to be trusted. No man is that quiet and self-assured unless he thinks he has things under his control."
Sinistrad glanced sidelong at his son.
"I don't like this exhibition of weakness I've discovered in you, Bane. You begin to remind me of your mother."
The child removed his arms slowly from around the dog's neck. Rising to his feet, Bane walked over to stand beside his father.
"We could get rid of Haplo. Then I could keep the dog and you wouldn't have to be nervous about it."
"An interesting idea, my son," answered Sinistrad, preoccupied. "Now take the beast out of here and run along and play."
"But, Papa, the dog's not hurting anything. He'll be quiet if I tell him to. See? He's just lying here."
Sinistrad looked down to see the dog looking up. The animal had remarkably intelligent eyes. The Mysteriarch frowned.
"I don't want him in here. He smells. Run along, both of you."
Sinistrad lifted one drawing, held it next to another, and regarded both thoughtfully.
"What was it originally designed to do? Something this gigantic, this enormous? What did the Sartan intend? Surely not just a means of gathering water."
"It produces the water to keep itself going," said Bane, clambering up on a stool to stand level with his father. "It needs the steam to run the engines to create the electricity that runs the machine. The Sartan probably built this part of the machine," Bane pointed, "to gather water and send it to the mid-realm. But it's obvious that this wasn't the machine's central function. You see, I..."
Bane caught his father's eye. The words died on the boy's lips. Sinistrad said nothing. Slowly, Bane slid down off the stool. The Mysteriarch, without another word, turned back to his perusing of the drawings. Bane walked to the door. The dog, rising to its feet, followed eagerly after, evidently thinking it was time to play. In the doorway, the boy halted and turned back.
"I know," he said.
"What?" Sinistrad, irritated, glanced up.
"I know why the Kixie Winsie was invented. I know what it was meant to do. I know how it can be made to do it. And I know how we can rule the entire world. I figured it out while I was making the drawings."
Sinistrad stared at the child. There was something of the boy's mother in the sweet mouth and the features, but it was his own shrewd and calculating eyes that stared fearlessly back at him. Sinistrad indicated the drawings with a negligent wave of his hand. "Show me." Bane, returning to the desk, did so. The dog, forgotten, plopped itself down at the wizard's feet. Chapter 50. Castle Sinister, High Realm. The tinkling of many unseen bells called Sinistrad's guests to dinner. The castle's dining room, no doubt having just been created, was windowless, large, dark, and chill. A long oaken table covered with dust stood in the center of the bleak chamber. Chairs draped in cloth ranged round it like guardian ghosts. The fireplace was cold and empty. The room had appeared right in front of the guests' noses, and they gathered within it, most of them ill at ease, to await the arrival of their host. Sauntering over to the table, Haplo ran his finger through an inch of dust and dirt. "I can hardly wait," he remarked, "to taste the food." Lights flared above them, hitherto unseen candelabrum flamed to brilliant life. The cloth draped over the chairs was whisked away by unseen hands. The dust vanished. The empty table was suddenly laden with food. Roast meat, steaming vegetables, fragrant breads. Goblets filled with wine and water appeared. Music played softly from some unseen source. Limbeck, gaping, tumbled backward and nearly fell into a roaring fire blazing on the hearth. Alfred nearly leapt out of his skin. Hugh could not repress a start, and backed away from the feast, eyeing it suspiciously. Haplo, smiling quietly, took a bua and bit into it. Footnote. Bua, a fruit of which humans are particularly fond. Its tart purple skin covers an almost sickeningly sweet pink meat inside. Those with educated palates believe nothing compares to the subtle blending of flavors when skin and meat are consumed simultaneously. The wine made from this fruit is much coveted by the elves, who, however, scorn eating the bua itself. End of footnote. Its crunch could be heard through the silence. He wiped juice from his chin. A pretty good illusion, he thought. Everyone will be fooled until about an hour from now, when they'll begin to wonder why they're still hungry. "Please, sit down," said Sinistrat, waving one hand. With the other he led in Iridol. Bane walked at his father's side. "We do not stand on ceremony here, my dear." Leading his wife to the end of the table, he seated her in a chair with a bow. "To reward Sir Hugh for his exertions in caring for you today, wife, I will place him at your right hand." Iridol flushed and kept her gaze on her plate. Hugh sat where he was told and did not appear displeased. "The rest of you find chairs where you will, except for Limbeck. My dear sir, please forgive me." Switching to the Geg's language, the wizard made a graceful bow. "I have been inconsiderate, forgetting that you do not speak the human tongue. My son has been telling me of your gallant struggle to free your people from oppression. Pray take a seat here near me and tell me about yourself. Do not worry about the other guests. My wife will entertain them." Sinistrat took his seat at the head of the table. Pleased, embarrassed, and flustered, Limbeck plunked his stout body into a chair at Sinistrad's right. Bane sat across from him on his father's left. Alfred hastened to secure a seat beside the prince. Haplo chose to seat himself at the opposite end of the long table, near Iridol and Hugh. The dog plopped down on the floor beside Bane. Taciturn and reticent as ever, Haplo could appear to be absorbed in his meal and could listen equally well to everyone's conversation.
"I hope you will forgive my indisposition this afternoon," said Iridol.
Though she spoke to Hugh, her eyes kept sliding, as if compelled to do so, to her husband, seated opposite her at the table's far end.
"I am subject to such spells. They come over me at times."
Sinistrad, watching her, nodded slightly. Iridol turned to Hugh and looked at him directly for the first time since he had taken his place beside her. She made an attempt at a smile.
"I hope you will ignore anything I said to you. The illness makes me talk about silly things."
"What you said wasn't silly," Hugh returned. "You meant every word. And you weren't sick. You were scared as hell."
There had been color in her cheeks when she entered. It drained as Hugh watched her. Glancing at her husband, Iridol swallowed and reached out her hand for her wine goblet.
"You must forget what I said. As you value your life, do not mention it again."
"My life is right now of very little value."
Hugh's hand caught hold of hers beneath the table and held it fast.
"Except as it can be used to serve you, Iridol."
"Try some of the bread," said Haplo, passing it to Hugh. "It's delicious. Sinistrad recommends it." The Mysteriarch was indeed watching them closely. Reluctantly releasing Iridol's hand, Hugh took a piece of bread and set it down, untasted, on his plate. Iridol toyed with her food and pretended to eat.
"Then, for my sake, don't refer to my words, especially if you will not act on them."
"I couldn't leave, knowing I left you behind in danger."
"You fool."
Iridol straightened, warmth sweeping her face.
"What can you do, a human who lacks the gift, against such as we? I am 10 times more powerful than you, 10 times better capable of defending myself if need be. Remember that."
"Forgive me, then." Hugh's dark face flushed. "It seemed you were in trouble."
"My troubles are my own, and none of your concern, sir."
"I will not bother you any more, madam. You may be certain of that."
Iridol did not answer, but stared at the food on her plate. Hugh ate stolidly and said nothing. Things now silent at his end of the table, Haplo turned his attention to the opposite. The dog, lying by Bane's chair, kept its ears pricked, gazing up at everyone eagerly, as if hoping for a choice bit to fall its direction.
But, Limbeck, you saw very little of the mid-realm, Sinistrad was saying.
I saw enough.
Limbeck blinked at him owlishly through his thick spectacles. The Geg had changed visibly during the past few weeks. The sights he had witnessed, the thoughts he had been thinking, had, like hammer and chisel, chipped away at his dreamy idealism. He had seen the life his people had been denied all these centuries, seen the life they were providing, all the while not sharing. The hammer's first blows hurt him. Later would come the rage.
I saw enough, Limbeck repeated.
Overwhelmed by the magic, the beauty, and his own emotions, he could think of nothing else to say.
Indeed you must have, answered the wizard. I'm truly grieved for your people. All of us in the High Realm share your sorrow and your very proper anger. I feel we must share in the blame. Not that we ever exploited you. We have no need, as you see around you, to exploit anyone. But still I feel that we are somewhat at fault.
He sipped delicately at his wine.
We left the world because we were sick of war, sick of watching people suffer and die in the name of greed and hatred. We spoke out against it and did what we could to stop it, but we were too few, too few.
There were actually tears in the man's voice. Haplo could have told him he was wasting a fine performance, at least for his end of the table. Iridol had long since given up any pretense of eating. She had been sitting silently, staring at her plate, until it became obvious that her husband's attention was centered on his conversation with the Geg. Then she raised her eyes, but their gaze did not go to her husband or to the man seated beside her. She looked at her son, seeing Bane, perhaps, for the first time since he'd arrived. Tears filled her eyes. Swiftly, she lowered her head. Lifting her hand to brush aside a stray lock of hair, she hastily wiped the drops from her cheeks. Hugh's hand, resting on the table opposite him, clenched in pain and anger. How had love's gilt-edged knife managed to penetrate a heart as tough as that one? Haplo didn't know, and he didn't care. All he knew was that it was damned inconvenient. The patron needed a man of action, since he was barred from action himself. It wouldn't do at all for Hugh to get himself killed in some foolish, noble, chivalric gesture. Haplo began to scratch his right hand, digging down beneath the bandages, displacing them slightly. The sigler exposed. He casually reached for more bread, managing, in the same movement, to press the back of his hand firmly against the wine pitcher. Grasping the bread in his right hand, he returned it to his plate, brushed his left hand over the bandages covering the right, and the runes were hidden once again.
Iridol, Hugh began, I can't bear to see you suffer.
Why should you care about me?
I'm damned if I know. Hugh leaned near her. You are your son. I...
More wine?
Haplo held up the pitcher. Hugh glowered, annoyed, and decided to ignore his companion. Haplo poured a glassful and shoved it toward Hugh. The goblet's base struck the man's fingers, and wine, real wine, sloshed on his hand and his shirt sleeve.
What the devil?
Hugh turned on the patron angrily. Haplo raised an eyebrow, obliquely nodding his head in the direction of the opposite end of the table. Attracted by the commotion, everyone, including Sinistrad, was staring at them. Iridol sat straight and tall, her face pale and cold as the marble walls. Hugh lifted the goblet and drank deeply. From his dark expression, it might have been the wizard's blood. Haplo smiled. He hadn't been any too soon. He waved a hunk of bread at Sinistrad.
Sorry, you were saying?
Frowning, the Mysteriarch continued.
I was saying that we should have realized what was happening to your people in the Low Realm and come to your aid. But we didn't know you were in trouble. We believed the stories that the Sartan had left behind. We did not know then that they were lying.
A sharp clatter made them all start. Alfred had dropped his spoon onto his plate.
What do you mean? What stories?
Limbeck was asking eagerly. After the Sundering, according to the Sartan, your people, being shorter in stature than humans and elves, were taken to the Low Realm for their own protection. Actually, as is now apparent, what the Sartan wanted was a source of cheap labor.
That's not true!
The voice was Alfred's. He hadn't spoken a word during the entire meal. Everyone, including Iridol, looked at him in astonishment. Sinistrad turned to him, his thin lips stretched in a polite smile.
No, and do you know what is the truth?
Red spread from Alfred's neck to his balding head.
I've made a study of the Gegs, you see.
Flustered, he tugged at and twisted the hem of the tablecloth.
Anyway, I think the Sartan intended to do... What you said about protection, it wasn't so much that the dwarf...
the Geggs were shorter and therefore in danger from the taller races, but that the Geggs, were few in number, following the Sundering. Then the dwarf... Geggs are very mechanically minded people, and the Sartan needed that for the machine. But they never meant... That is, they always meant to...
Hugh's head slumped forward and hit the table with a thud. Illidore sprang from her chair, crying out in alarm. Haplo was on his feet and moving.
"It's nothing," he said, reaching Hugh's side.
Slipping the assassin's flaccid arm around his neck, Haplo lifted the heavy body from the chair. Hugh's limp hand dragged at the cloth, knocked over goblets, and sent a plate crashing to the floor.
"Good man, but a weak head for wine. I'll take him to his room. No need for the rest of you to be disturbed."
"Are you certain he's all right?" Irritable hovered over them anxiously. "Perhaps I should come..."
"A drunk has passed out at your table, my dear. There is hardly any need for concern," Sinistrad said. "Remove him by all means."
"Can I keep the dog?"
asked Bane, petting the animal, which, seeing its master preparing to leave, had jumped to its feet.
"Sure," said Haplo easily. "Dog, stay."
The dog settled happily back down at Bane's side. Haplo got Hugh to his feet. Weaving drunkenly, the man was just barely able to stagger, with help, toward the door. Everyone else resumed his seat. Alfred's words were forgotten. Sinistrad turned back to Limbeck. "This Kixie whimsy of yours fascinates me. I believe that since I now have a ship at my disposal, I will journey down to your realm and take a look at it. Of course, I will also be quite pleased to do what I can to help your people prepare for the war."
"War?"
The word echoed in the hall. Haplo, glancing back over his shoulder, saw Limbeck's face, troubled and pale.
"My dear Geg, I didn't mean to shock you." Sinistrad smiled at him kindly. "War being the next logical step, I simply assumed that you would come here for this very purpose, to ask my support. I can assure you the Geggs will have the full cooperation of my people."
Sinistrad's words came through the dog's ears to Haplo, who was carrying a stumbling Hugh into a dark and chill corridor. He was just wondering which direction the guest rooms were located from the dining room when a hallway materialized before him. Several doors stood invitingly open.
"I hope no one walks in his sleep," Haplo muttered to his besotted companion.
Back in the dining room, the patron could hear the rustle of Iridal's silken gown and her chair scrape against the stone floor. Her voice, when she spoke, was tight with controlled anger.
"If you will excuse me, I will retire to my room now."
"Not feeling well, are you, my dear?"
"Thank you, I'm feeling fine."
She paused, then added,
"It is late. The boy should be in his bed."
"Yes, wife, I'll see to it. No need to trouble yourself. Bane, bid your mother good night."
Well, it had been an interesting evening. Fake food, fake words. Haplo eased Hugh onto his bed and covered him with a blanket. The assassin wouldn't wake from the spell until morning. Haplo retired to his own room. Entering, he shut the door and slid home the bolt. He needed time to rest and think undisturbed, assimilate all that he had heard today. Voices continued to come to him through the dog. Their words were unimportant. Everyone was parting to rest for the night. Lying down on his bed, the patron sent out a silent command to the animal, then began to sort out his thoughts. The Kixie whimsy. He'd deduced its function from the flickering images portrayed on the eyeball held in the hand of the Manger, the Sartan flouting their power, proudly announcing their grand design. Haplo could see the images again in his mind. He could see the drawing of the world, the realm of sky. He saw the isles and continents scattered about in disorder, the raging storm that was both death-dealing and life-giving, everything moving in the chaotic manner so abhorrent to the order-loving Sartan. When had they discovered their mistake? When had they found out that the world they created for the removal of a people after the Sundering was imperfect? After they had populated it, did they realize then that the beautiful floating islands in the sky were dry and barren and could not nurture the life that had been placed in their trust? The Sartan would fix it. They had fixed everything else, split apart a world rather than let those they considered unworthy rule it. The Sartan would build a machine that, combined with their magic, would align the isles and the continents. Closing his eyes, Haplo saw the pictures again clearly. A tremendous force beaming up from the Kixie Whimsy catches hold of the continents and the isles, drags them through the skies, and aligns them one right above the other. A geyser of water drawn from the constant storm shoots upward continually, bringing the life-giving substance to everyone. Haplo had figured out the puzzle. He was rather surprised that Bane had solved it as well. Now Sinistrad knew, and he had most obligingly explained his plans to his son and to the listening dog. One flick of the Kixie Whimsy's switch, and the Mysteriarch would rule a realigned world. The dog jumped up on the bed and settled itself at Haplo's side. Lazily, relaxed to the point of sleep, the patron stretched out his arm and patted the dog on the flank. With a contented sigh, the animal rested its head on Haplo's chest and closed its eyes. What criminal folly, Haplo thought, stroking the dog's soft ears, to build something this powerful and then walk away and leave it to fall into the hands of some ambitious mensch. Footnote. Mensch, a word used by both patrons and Sartan to refer to those less gifted with power than themselves. It is applied equally to elves, humans, and dwarves. End of footnote. Haplo couldn't imagine why they had done it. For all their faults, the Sartan weren't fools. Something had happened to them before they could finish their project. He wished he knew what. This was the clearest sign he could imagine, however, to prove that the Sartan were no longer in the world. An echo came to him, words spoken by Alfred during the confusion of Hugh's drunken swoon, words probably heard only by the dog and transferred dutifully to the master. They thought they were gods. They tried to do right. But somehow it all kept going wrong. Chapter 51. Castle Sinister, High Realm.
Papa, I'm going with you to Drevlin.
No, and stop arguing with me, Bane. You must return to the Mid-Realm and take your place on the throne.
But I can't go back. Stephen wants to kill me.
Don't be stupid, child. I haven't time for it. In order for you to inherit the throne, Stephen and his queen must be dead. That will be arranged. In essence, of course. I will be the one who is truly ruling the Mid-Realm. But I can't be in two places at once. I will be on the Low Realm preparing the machine. Don't snivel. I can't abide it. His father's words sounded over and over again in Bane's head like the screeching of some irritating nighttime insect that will not permit sleep. I will be the one who is truly ruling the Mid-Realm. Yes, and where would you be now, Papa, if I hadn't shown you how? Lying on his back, stiff and rigid in the bed, the boy clutched handfuls of the fleecy blanket that covered him. Bane didn't cry. Tears were a valuable weapon in his fight against adults. He had often found them useful against Stephen and Anne. Tears alone in the darkness were a weakness, so his father would think. But what did he care what his father thought? Bane gripped the blanket hard, and the tears almost came anyway. Yes, he cared. He cared so much it hurt him inside. Bane could remember clearly the day he had come to realize that the people he knew as his parents only adored him. They didn't love him. Having escaped from Alfred, he was loitering about the kitchen, teasing the cook for bites of sweet dough, when one of the stable boys ran in, wailing over a scratch from a dragon's claw. It was the cook's son, a lad not much older than Bane, who'd been put to work with his father, one of the dragon tenders. The cut wasn't serious. Cook cleaned it and bound it with a strip of cloth. Then, taking the child in her arms, kissed him heartily, hugged him, and sent him back to his chores. The boy ran off with a glowing face, the pain and fright of his injury quite forgotten. Bane had been watching from a corner. Just the day before, he'd cut his hand on a chipped goblet. There'd been a flurry of excitement. Tryon had been summoned. He'd brought with him a solid silver knife passed through flame, healing herbs, and cobweb to staunch the bleeding. The offending goblet had been smashed. Alfred had come near being sacked over the incident. King Stephen shouted at the poor chamberlain for 20 minutes running. Queen Anne had nearly fainted at the sight and been forced to leave the room. His mother had not kissed him. She had not taken him into her arms and made him laugh to forget the pain. Bane had derived a certain satisfaction from beating up the stable boy, a satisfaction compounded by the fact that the stable boy had been severely punished for fighting with the prince. That night Bane asked the voice of the feather amulet, the soft and whispering voice that often spoke to him during the night, to explain why his parents didn't love him. The voice told him the truth. Stephen and Anne weren't his real parents. Bane was just using them for a while. His true father was a powerful mysteriarch. His true father dwelt in a splendid castle in a fabulous realm. His true father was proud of his son, and the day would come when he would call his son home, and they would be together always. The last part of the sentence was Bane's addition, not, I will be the one who is truly ruling the Mid-Realm. Letting go of the blanket, the boy grasped hold of the feather amulet he wore around his neck and jerked hard on the leather thong. It would not break. Angrily, using words he'd picked up from the stable boy, Bane pulled at it again, harder, and succeeded only in hurting himself. Tears came to his eyes at last, tears of pain and frustration. Sitting up in bed, he pulled and tugged, and finally, after costing himself more pain by getting the thong tangled in his hair, managed to drag it up over and off his head. Alfred was passing down the hallway, searching for his own bedchamber in the confusing, forbidding palace.
Limbeck is falling under the sway of the Mysteriarch. I can see the bloody conflict into which the Geggs will be drawn. Thousands will die, and for what? To gain an evil man control of the world.
I should stop it, but how? What can I do alone? Or maybe I shouldn't stop it. After all, I was attempting to control what should have been left alone that brought tragedy on us all. And then there is Haplo. I know for certain who he is. But again, what can I do? Should I do anything? I don't know. I don't know. Why was I left by myself? Is it a mistake? Or am I supposed to be doing something? And if so, what?
End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over. The Chamberlain, in his aimless ramblings, found himself near Bane's door. His inner turmoil made the dark and shadowy hall swim before his eyes. Pausing until his vision cleared, wishing desperately his thoughts would do the same, Alfred heard the rustle of bedclothes and the child's voice crying and cursing. Glancing up and down the hall to make certain he was not seen, Alfred raised 2 fingers on his right hand and traced the sign of a sigil on the door. The wood seemed to disappear at his command, and he could see through it as if it were not there. Bane hurled the amulet into a corner of the room.
No one loves me, and I'm glad of it. I don't love them. I hate them, all of them.
The boy flung himself down onto the bed, buried his head in the pillow. Alfred drew a deep and shaking breath. At last, it had happened at last, and just when his heart was despairing. Now was the time to draw the boy back from the edge of Sinistrad's pit. Alfred stepped forward, forgetting the door, and narrowly missed bumping right into it, for the spell he had cast had not removed it, merely let him see through it. The Chamberlain caught himself and, at the same time, thought, no, not me. What am I, a servant, nothing more? His mother. Yes, his mother. Bane heard a sound in his room and promptly shut his eyes and froze. He had the blanket pulled over his head, and he hastily dried his tears with a quick flick of his hand. Was it Sinistrad coming to say he'd changed his mind?
Bane? The voice was soft and gentle, his mother's.
The boy pretended to be sleeping. What does she want, he wondered. Do I want to talk to her? Yes, he decided, hearing once again his father's words, I think I do want to speak to mother. All my life, people have used me to get what they wanted. Now I'm going to start using them. Blinking sleepily, Bane raised a tousled head from the depth of the blankets. Iridol had materialized inside his room and was standing at the foot of his bed. Light slowly began to illuminate her, shining from within, and casting a warm and lovely radiance over the boy. The rest of the room remained in darkness. Looking at his mother, Bane knew, from the pitying expression that swept over her face, that she saw he had been crying. This was good. Once again he drew on his arsenal.
Oh, my child.
His mother came to him. Sitting down on the bed, Iridol slid her arm around him and drew him close, soothing him with her hand. A feeling of exquisite warmth enveloped the boy. Nestling into that comforting arm, he said to himself, I've given father what he wants. Now it's her turn. What does she want of me? Nothing, apparently. Iridol wept over him and murmured incoherently about how much she had missed him and how she had longed for him to be with her. This gave the boy an idea.
Mother,
he said, looking up at her with tear-drenched blue eyes,
I want to be with you, but father says he's going to send me away.
Send you away? Where? Why?
Back to the mid-realm. Back to those people who don't love me.
He caught hold of her hand and hugged it tightly.
I want to stay with you, you and father.
Yes, Iridol murmured. Drawing Bane close, she kissed him on the forehead.
Yes, a family, like I've always dreamed. Maybe there is a chance. Maybe I can't save him but his own child. Surely he could not betray such innocent love and trust. This hand...
She kissed the child's fingers, veining them with tears.
This hand might lead him away from the dark path he walks.
Bane didn't understand. All paths were one to him, neither dark nor light, all leading straight to the same goal, people doing what he wanted them to do.
You'll talk to father,
he said, squirming out of her grasp, feeling that, after all, kissing and hugging might get to be a nuisance.
Yes, I'll talk to him tomorrow. Thank you, Mama,
Bane yawned.
You should be sleeping, Iridol said, rising. Good night, my son.
She gently drew the blanket up snug around him and, leaning down, kissed his cheek.
Good night.
The magical radiance began to fade from her face. She raised her hands and closed her eyes, concentrating, and disappeared from his room. Bane grinned into the darkness. He had no idea what kind of influence his mother might be able to exert. He could only judge by Queen Anne, who had generally been able to get what she wanted from Stephen. But if this didn't work, there was always the other plan.
In order to make that plan work, he would have to give away for free something he guessed was of inestimable value. He would be circumspect, of course, but his father was smart. Sinistrad might guess and rob him of it. Still, spend nothing, gain nothing. Likely he wouldn't have to give it up. Not yet. He wouldn't be sent away. Mama would see to that. Gleefully, Bane kicked off the smothering covers. Chapter 52. Castle Sinister, High Realm. The following morning, Iridul entered her husband's study. She found her son there with Sinistrad, the two of them seated at her husband's writing desk, poring over drawings made by Bane. The dog, lying at her son's feet, lifted its head when it saw her, its tail thumping the floor. Iridul paused a moment in the doorway. All her fantasies had come true. Loving father, adoring son. Sinistrad patiently devoting his time to Bane, studying whatever the boy had done with an assumed gravity that was quite endearing. In that instant, seeing the skull-capped head bent so near the fair-haired one, hearing the murmur of the voices, one young and one old, caught up in the excitement of what she could only think was some childish project of her son's, Iridul forgave Sinistrad everything. Her years of terror and suffering she would gladly erase, banish from her memory, if only he would grant her this. Stepping forward almost shyly, it had been many years since she had set foot in her husband's sanctum, Iridul tried to speak but couldn't find her voice. The choked sound caught the attention of both son and father, however. One looked up at her with a radiant, charming smile. The other appeared annoyed.
"Well, wife, what do you want?"
Iridul's fantasies wavered, their bright mist shredded by the chill voice and the icy gaze of the lashless eyes.
"Good morning, Mama," said Bane. "Would you like to see my drawings? I made them myself."
"If I am not disturbing..." She looked hesitantly at Sinistrad.
"Come in, then," he said ungraciously.
"Why, Bane, these are marvelous."
Iridul lifted a few pages and turned them to the light of the sun. "I used my magic, like Father taught me. I thought of what I wanted to draw, and my hands took over and did it. I learned magic very quickly," said the boy, gazing up at his mother with wide-eyed charm. "You and Father could teach me in your spare time. I wouldn't be any trouble."
Sinistrad sat back in his chair, the robes of heavy, watered silk rustling dryly like bat wings. His lips creased in a chill smile that blew the tattered remnants of Iridul's fancies from the skies. She would have fled to her chambers had not Bane been watching her hopefully, silently pleading with her to continue. The dog laid its head back down between its paws, its eyes moving alertly to whoever spoke.
"What are these drawings?" she faltered. "The great machine?" "Yes. Look, this is the part they call the Wombe. Papa says that means womb, and it's where the Kixiwinsy was born. And this part activates the great force that will pull all of the isles..."
"That will do, Bane," interrupted Sinistrad. "We mustn't keep your mother from the entertaining of our... guests."
He lingered over the word. The look he gave her made her skin flush crimson and scattered her thoughts in confusion.
"I assume you came here for some purpose, wife? Or perhaps it was just to make certain that my time was occupied so that you and the dark and handsome assassin..."
"How dare... What? What did you say?"
Iridul's hands began to shake. Hurriedly, she laid the pages of drawings she'd been holding back on the desk.
"Didn't you know, my dear? One of your guests is a professional knife man. Hugh the Hand is what he calls himself. A hand stained in blood, if you will forgive my small jest. Your gallant champion was hired to murder a child." Sinistrad ruffled Bane's hair. "But for me, wife, your boy would never have come home to you. I thwarted Hugh's design."
"I don't believe you. It's not possible."
"I know it's shocking for you, my dear, to discover that we have a house guest who might murder us all in our beds. But I've taken every precaution. He did me a favor by drinking himself into a blind stupor last night. It was quite simple to transfer his wine-soaked body to a place of safekeeping. My son tells me that there is a price on the man's head, as well as that of the boy's treacherous servant. The amount will be just enough to finance my project in the Low Realm. And now, my dear, what was it you wanted?"
"Don't take my son from me."
Iridul gasped for breath, feeling as if cold water had been dashed over her.
"Do whatever you want. I will not stop you. Just leave me my son."
"Only the other morning you disclaimed him. Now you say you want him."
Sinistrad shrugged. "Really, madam, I can't subject the boy to your idle whims that change daily. He must return to the mid-realm and take up his duties. Now I think you had better go. So nice that we could have this little chat, wife. We must do it more often."
"I do think, Mama, that you might have talked this over with me first," interjected Bane. "I want to go back. I'm certain Father knows what's best for me."
I'm certain he does, said Iridul.
Turning, she walked with quiet dignity out of the study and managed to make it down the chill, shadowy hallway before she wept for her lost child. As for you, Bane, said Sinistrad, returning each of the drawings Iridul had disturbed to its proper place, never try that with me again. This time I punished your mother, who should have known better. Next time it will be you. Bane accepted the rebuke in silence. It was refreshing to play the game with an opponent as skilled as himself for a change. He began to deal out the next hand, moving swiftly so that his father would not notice the cards were coming from the bottom of a prearranged deck.
Father, said Bane, I have a question about magic.
Yes? Now that discipline had been restored, Sinistrad was pleased at the boy's interest.
One day I saw Tryon drawing something on a sheet of paper. It was a letter of the alphabet, but yet it wasn't. When I asked him, he crumpled it up and looked embarrassed and threw it away. He said it was magic and I mustn't bother him about it.
Sinistrad turned his attention from the drawing he was perusing to his son. Bane returned the sharp-eyed, curious gaze with the ingenuous expression the child knew so well how to assume. The dog sat up and shoved his nose in the child's hand, wanting to be petted. What did the symbol look like? On the back of one of the drawings, Bane traced a rune. That, Sinistrad snorted, that is a sigil used in rune magic. This Tryon must be more of a fool than I thought to be dabbling in that arcane art.
Why?
Because only the Sartan were skilled in the use of runes.
The Sartan? The child appeared awed. No others?
Well, it was said that in the world which existed before the Sundering, the Sartan had a mortal enemy, a group as powerful and more ambitious, a group who wanted to use their godlike powers to rule instead of to guide. They were known as the Patrons.
And you're certain no one else can use this magic?
Haven't I said so once? When I say a thing, I mean it.
I'm sorry, Father.
Now that he was certain, Bane could afford to be magnanimous to a losing opponent.
What does the rune do, Father?
Sinistrad glanced at it. A rune of healing, I believe, he said without interest. Bane smiled and petted the dog, which gratefully licked his fingers. Chapter 53. Castle Sinister, High Realm. The effects of the spell were slow to wear off. Hugh could not distinguish between dream and reality. One moment the black monk was standing at his side, taunting him.
Death's master? No, we are your masters. All your life you have served us.
And then the black monk was Sinistrad. Why not serve me? I could use a man of your talents. Stephen and Anne must be dealt with. My son must sit on the throne of both Volcaron and Eulandia, and these two stand in his way. A clever man like you could figure out how their deaths could be accomplished. I've work to do, but I'll return later. Remain here and think about it. Here was a dank cell that had been created out of nothing and nowhere. Sinistrad had carried Hugh to this place, wherever it was. The assassin had resisted, but not much. It's difficult to fight when you can barely tell the floor from the ceiling. Your feet seem to have multiplied, and your legs lost their bones. Of course it was Sinistrad who cast the spell on me. Hugh could vaguely remember trying to tell Haplo he wasn't drunk, that this was some terrible magic. But Haplo had only smiled that infuriating smile of his, and said he'd feel better when he'd slept it off. Maybe when Haplo wakes up and discovers I'm gone, he'll come looking for me. Hugh held his pounding head in his hands and cursed himself for a fool. Even if Haplo does go looking for me, he'll never find me. This prison cell isn't located in the bowels of the castle, placed conveniently at the bottom of a long and winding stair. I saw the void out of which it sprang. It's at the bottom of night, the middle of nowhere. No one will ever find me. I'll stay here until I die, or until I call Sinistrad master. And why not? I've served many men. What's one more? Or better yet, maybe I'll just stay where I am. This cell isn't much different from my life. A cold, bleak, and empty prison. I built the walls myself, made them out of money. I shut myself in and locked the door. I was my own guard, my own jailer. And it worked. Nothing has touched me. Pain, compassion, pity, remorse, they couldn't get past the walls. I even considered killing a child for the money. And then the child got hold of the key. But that had been the enchantment. It was his magic that made me pity him. Or was that my excuse? Certainly the enchantment didn't conjure up those memories of myself before the prison cell. The enchantment works only because you want it to work. Your will feeds it. You could have broken it long ago if you truly wanted to. You care about him, you see, and caring is an invisible prison. Perhaps not. Perhaps it was freedom.
Dazed, half-waking, half-dreaming, Hugh rose from where he'd been sitting on the stone floor and walked to the cell door. He reached out his hand and stopped and stared. His hand was covered with blood. The wrist, forearm, he was smeared in blood to the elbow. And as he saw himself, so must she see him.
Sir?
Hugh started and turned his head. Was she real, or was she only a trick of his throbbing mind that had been thinking about her? He blinked, and she did not go away.
Iridol?
Seeing in her eyes that she knew the truth about him, he glanced down self-consciously at his hands.
So Sinistrad was right, Iridol said. You are an assassin.
The rainbow eyes were gray and colorless. There was no light shining behind them. What could he say? She spoke the truth. He could excuse himself, tell her about Three Chop Nick. He could tell her how he had decided he couldn't harm the boy. He could tell her that he had planned to take the boy back to Queen Anne. But none of it made different the fact that he had agreed. He had taken the money, he had known in his heart he could kill a child. And so he simply and quietly said, yes.
I don't understand. It's evil, monstrous. How could you spend your life murdering people?
He could say that most of the men he'd killed deserved to die. He could tell her that he had probably saved the lives of those who would have become their next victims. But Illidan would ask him, who are you to judge? And he would answer, who is any man? Who is King Stephen that he can proclaim, that man is an elf and therefore he must die? Who are the barons that they can say, that man has land I want, he won't give it to me and therefore he must die? Fine arguments, I agreed. I took the money, I knew in my heart I could kill a child, and so he said, it doesn't matter now.
No, except that I am alone, again.
Iridol spoke softly. Hugh knew he hadn't been meant to hear. She stood in the center of the cell, her head bowed, the long white hair falling forward, hiding her face. She had cared for him, trusted him. She had perhaps been going to ask him for help. His cell door swung slowly open, sunlight flooding into his soul.
Iridol, you're not alone. There's someone you can trust. Alfred's a good man. He's devoted to your son.
Far more than Bane deserves, Hugh thought, but didn't say. Aloud, he continued,
Alfred saved the boy's life once when a tree fell on him. If you want to escape, you and your son, Alfred could help you. He could take you to the elven ship. The elf captain needs money. He'd give you passage in return for that and safe guidance out of the firmament.
Escape? Iridol glanced frantically around the cell walls, and then she buried her face in her hands. It was not Hugh's cell walls she saw, but her own. So she too was a prisoner. I opened her cell door, offered her a glimpse of light and air, and now she sees it swinging shut.
Iridol, I'm a murderer. Worse, I've murdered for money. I make no excuses for myself. But what I've done is nothing to what your husband's plotting.
You're wrong. He's never taken a life. He couldn't do such a thing.
He's talking about world war, Iridol, sacrificing the lives of thousands to put himself into power.
You don't understand. It's our lives he's trying to save, the lives of our people. Seeing his puzzled expression, she made an impatient